All right, I think we're ready to kick off for the last concurrent session before we head for afternoon tea and then into the final plenary. So, very happy to be here. I'm your chair for this session. We couldn't actually get somebody from the younger generation to chair this session, so you're stuck with me instead. So we'll just do a 35-minute presentation from Al and Mark and then Q&A at the end as per normal. So we'll save questions until the end, but please do use the Q&A app the Q&A tool on the app to send through your questions throughout the session, but we'll pick them up at the end. So we have two speakers from Deloitte, Mark and Al. Mark is a director and has a very keen interest in the future of the life insurance industry and the actuarial profession as well. He was a co-author of the 2016 Green Paper that was commissioned by the Actuaries Institute on the impact of big data on the future of insurance. And he was also a lead author on a Deloitte thought leadership paper called Mind the Gap, How to Provide the Australian Community with the Life Insurance that it Needs. And that's the basis for this presentation. Al is a partner at Deloitte and with close on 40 years of experience in the industry, probably doesn't need any introduction to many of you in the room, but has a wealth of experience across the complete value chain and the life insurance market. While not a member of the younger generation, Al has insisted that he is very much young at heart and very much enjoys working with the younger generation of actuaries to challenge the current thinking and indeed the status quo. So with that, I'll hand you over to Al.
Thanks, David. We did work out that Mark wasn't born when I started in the industry, so there is a bit of an age gap between us, although I don't think you class as younger generation either, just to make clear, Mark. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the peoples of this land before we move into the rest of the presentation, elders past and present. And thank you for coming along. The Mind the Gap research was mentioned. We presented, I think it was Summit last time, on this broader topic, which we're both very passionate about, and we've framed it now serving the underserved and picked up some language around that. But this last time we presented on the broader need and the gap that existed, and this time we're going a bit more into a specific segment where we see needs and to talk about really to stretch the thinking a bit on how the industry can try and solve for some of the gap that exists with particularly the younger segment. So, first of all, was anyone here when we did the presentation? Do you remember Alex and who? What was the name of the other person? There was Alex, actually, I think it might have been Alex and Al, and we had Alex at 22 and Al at 58, it was then, I think. Alex actually looks very much like my son, and if you can't see at the back, please feel free to come forward and get a bit closer to the text. We're not going to talk to all the text. But Alex has just left home, is renting, started his career and doesn't have any debt. And he's the sort of person that we're trying to think about at the youngest age range that we talk about as a potential insurance need. And I'll come back to some of the reason he does have insurance needs. But we're trying to address that there are gaps in insurance for people like Alex and all the way through to 35. And we've roughly classified the younger generation from 20 to 35. And that probably fits with the people that the advisors don't typically want to talk to at the moment as well. Why are they interesting? Well, there's a lot of them. There's, I think, I've got my notes here, about 11 million people. So that's the community that we could be talking to. Their total income is quite large, in the hundreds of millions of dollars per annum. So if you use that old rubbishy rule of thumb of 1% of salary paid to insurance that came out of superannuation somebody made up and we all try and avoid, but even if you use that, there's a fair lot of money sitting there that could be spent on something that today the younger generation doesn't know about or think about and certainly doesn't think of as essential. So if you went to a sort of addressable problem, there's actually quite a bit of money there. And there are more people in this segment than we serve in the whole retail advised market. So think about that for a moment. We're going after stealing share from each other in the retail advised market, and yet there's this market that is actually not being addressed by us really at all. So the main point we want to start with is that there is an opportunity. There are needs, and to give the example of my son Josh, he's actually a budding actor, which means he's got three casual jobs, does auditions, occasionally gets paid pretty badly to do some acting work. What happens when he gets sick? Anybody? Yep, that's right. And fortunate position that we can, but that shouldn't be, that's not the case for lots of other people. He doesn't have sick leave because he's casual. He doesn't actually have workers' comp because he's casual. So he ends up sick, unable to work for a little while and having no income. My daughter, similarly, she's actually just had knee reconstruction, living at home temporarily. Classic example of a need, and it's not full comprehensive death, TPD, IP and all the bells and whistles that they need. Actually, it's probably something really simple. So we'll come back to that topic a bit more as we head through the presentation, and I'll hand to Mark.
So Al's told us a little bit about why we should care, but let's focus a bit on the current environment and how did we get here? Why are there underinsured younger people? What are some of the headwinds and obstacles we need to overcome? And then we'll talk also a little bit about some of the emerging tailwinds and some of the green shoots. So what are the obstacles that's led to where we are? So one is under design distribution obligations, we have to define our target market. And let's be honest, how many products are defined or built specifically for younger people? Not many. Then in the retail advisor space, far fewer advisors are now in the market, which means the remaining advisors have moved up the value chain, serving higher net worth individuals. Younger people cannot afford generally to pay for financial advice, so therefore they don't have access to advisors. In the direct space, there's been a slowdown, a lot of exits in that market post-Royal Commission and post-ASIC reviews, just because of the perceived risk. Banks, affinity groups, etc. No one wants to talk to their customers about insurance. It's just perceived as being, you know, too hard, too risky. And then PYS and PMIF in the group insurance space, we know that younger people have been disproportionately impacted by that and have lost, you know, cover as a result. That's some of the regulatory obstacles. In terms of the structural or behavioral barriers, there is low engagement. So as I said, a lot of young people either don't have insurance and superannuation, or those that do believe, right, I've got my default cover, job done, nothing more to do, don't need to further engage. There's also low financial literacy. So life insurance is complex, and a lot of people, young people in particular, feel, oh, don't know where to start, too complex, would rather not engage in the topic at all. They also have lower disposable incomes, and therefore when they need to balance out where do they spend their money, unfortunately, life insurance is seen as a sort of a future need. Well, we'll put that aside for now. There's more immediate needs that's calling for their wallet. Life insurance does have siloed systems, and the experience is vastly different depending on whether you're going through your super fund, you're going through an advisor, you're going direct to an insurer, you're going through a broker. It's a very, very different, disjointed experience. And then there's obviously a lot of misconceptions in the market, such as, oh, I'm young, I don't need insurance, or as I said, I've got sufficient cover in my superannuation, or, you know, a whole bunch of other reasons that misconceptions that young people have, which is why they choose just not to engage with insurance. Mm-hmm. So what are the main blockers that we need to address? So one is finding distribution channels that make sense to reach these customers. We can't just rely on the distribution channels we've got at the moment. It's thinking differently about how to actually reach them. Two, how do we make products that are fit for the market and make sense again for younger people? And finally, it's about creating perceived value for young individuals because they are more discerning in how they spend their money. They do more research. They want to understand if you're not offering them, it's not only about actual value, but perceived value, then they tend to stay away from the product. So that's the negatives. But what are some of the green shoots and what are some of the tailwinds that are hopefully going to work in our favor towards addressing this need? So firstly, quality of advice review. Some of the recommendations that came out of that have been really helpful. It's opened the door to more scalable and affordable financial advice and encouraged innovation in how we deliver guidance. So we're moving beyond the traditional one-to-one models of delivering advice. And importantly, it's enabling, or hopefully will enable, tools like robo-advice or, you know, digital guidance tools, which is really necessary to reach the younger generation at scale. Following on from quality advice, delivering better financial outcomes, it's going to give, hopefully, super funds more flexibility to engage with members on both retirement and insurance, which means that they can explain insurance more clearly. They can provide tailored guidance to individual members' circumstances and support improved engagement around certain decisions, around key life stages. On COVID-19, we know that that's led to an environment, there's some positives about COVID-19, but it has led to people being more risk aware and more aware of their health and potentially financial risks. So that may lead to more engagement. We've seen some positive signs around distribution deals between affinity groups and insurers. And again, these distribution groups or these affinity groups may have access to more niche and harder to reach populations, such as younger people. And it's about if we manage to connect with those people, we can actually reach an audience that we were unable to reach before. So on the notion of how do we reach younger people, so firstly, it's distribution channel, right? How do we think about distribution channel? I mentioned earlier the challenges around advisors and retail advice space. I mentioned challenges with group insurance. So beyond those two sort of main channels, how do we think differently about distribution channel? And there's not going to be one-size-fits-all approach. Potentially, it's going to be a combination of channels. And there's always going to be trade-offs between the different channels. So we've just come up with a model on the left there. It said, right, these are four elements broadly that maybe you should try and balance off when thinking about distribution channel. It's the reach. So how easy is it for the channel to access and scale across these larger and harder to reach customer segments? Trust. So what is the level of consumer confidence in that channel, or in the brand, or in the, you know, insurer or whoever is delivering that product? Control, which is how much influence the insurer has over the customer experience and the journey. And then finally is education, is ability to actually inform, explain, and help customers make these decisions. So it's just an illustrative framework, but we thought about, you know, four different distribution channels: business to business to consumer, white label, embedded, and direct to consumer. And the top three broadly, the aim is really around how do you leverage trusted brands, trusted platforms, trusted apps, trusted institutions that younger people are already engaging with and trust. So how do you leverage them to, whether it is to provide leads, whether it is to directly sell your insurance, or whether it is to embed it into the purchasing journey of potentially something else. So you obviously, you get the reach, you get the trust, but of course the insurer then falls further behind the sort of curtain and is more invisible and doesn't have the ability to necessarily control that interaction. On the other hand, you can go direct to consumers, and that gives you maximum control, maximum ability to educate and clarity, but it needs to be through digital journeys, because if you want to reach younger people, they want digital-first experiences. And so that's going to require strong digital design and brand awareness, and that can be expensive and difficult to scale. And therefore, you potentially lose some of the other things around reach. So it's one thing thinking about channels and how do we get to people, but in actual fact, taking it one step backwards, it's awareness. How do we actually create awareness so when the channel gets to the person, or the person's at the position that they should be buying insurance, they're actually aware of their need. They know what they need to buy. They know why they need to buy it. And they're actually ready to purchase at that point in time. We have to address awareness. And there's so many moments in a person's life, in particular, we've picked some life stages that young people will go through, where it just makes sense to have the conversation, whether it is an opportunity to educate, whether it's just a general conversation, whether it's an opportunity to refer out or even potentially sell or insurance. But there's many touch points throughout a person's life where it just makes sense to partner with certain institutions, for life insurance to partner. So taking the example of taking out a mortgage. So a stat is 92% of millennials and Gen Z have or intend to purchase a property. So that means pretty much all young people are hopefully going to go through the stage. I know it's becoming a lot more challenging, but at least aspire to. And so when you go through the stage of buying a property, I mean, it's the most obvious purchase that when you take out a mortgage, you need protection. What will happen? How are you going to pay that debt? It's one of the most basic things that life insurance covers. But yet we don't seem to have that conversation enough when you take out a mortgage. And there's very few, you know, advisors that work across and holistically, you know, sell you a mortgage and then try offer you life insurance. In terms of another stat, and this is broader than just younger people, but 86% of people met with a GP during 2023. So again, the majority of people in any given year are meeting with their GP. They're talking about health concerns largely. Isn't that an opportune moment to be having that sort of discussion and education? So that's just, you know, I'll pick a couple of touch points. I'm not going to go through them all. Finally, I mentioned one of the key blockers to address is around perceived value. And as I say, that sometimes that is actual value, but sometimes it is perceived value. And life insurance, by its nature, is a low-touch product. So in particular, for younger people who have lower claim rates, there really is a low level of engagement. Yeah, you engage maybe once a year, you pay your premiums or you get a renewal, but you may not even engage. You may be on a direct debit and you may or may not claim further down the line. But how do we change that relationship to be actually high engagement and focus on delivering engaging experiences to younger people? So whether it is offering things like wellness tools or personalized content or awards, it's how do we build that early brand connection with people to have that constant level of engagement? If we do that, moving to the next step, which is long-term loyalty strategy, once you offer benefits to someone, and as I say, this is non-claim benefits in addition to the claim benefits, once you're offering someone something beneficial and they get engaged in your platform, in your program, in your brand, they become more sticky customers. Then later on, when you have to increase premiums, they're potentially less likely to lapse. Once you have so-called acquired that customer, you've then bought the right to have almost first right of refusal, to have the conversation later on in life when their needs change. And now they need a more holistic product because now they're married or they've got kids or they've taken out the mortgage or whatever. You're front and center to be able to have that conversation and sell them that product. Finally, we need to think about not just lifetime value of a policy, but lifetime value of a customer. And customers can purchase multiple products over time, as I say, starting from the cheap, simple product, eventually to the more comprehensive cover over time. But if we just look at the economics of that first policy, and as I said earlier, younger people have affordability challenges. So how do we make it cheaper for them? How do we offer them more benefits? Now you say, well, if they can't even afford the current benefits, how do we add other non-claim benefits on top of that? But that's going to require investment from insurers. Now, whether that's investment via shareholders or whether we somehow cross-subsidize in other ways, but it's actually how do you try and invest to make the product affordable and attractive to younger people? Because we know that if you are able to get someone in when they are young, as I say, we can think about this in terms of the lifetime value that customer can generate. So the return on the investment needs to be considered not just on that initial policy.
So what do we do about all that?
You might notice we actually haven't talked about products. We haven't told you what products should be sold. And that's intentional because for two reasons. One, the first thing is the products we have today are not the right products for this generation or actually potentially even for who we're selling them to today. But that's a whole separate discussion, which I think is happening in another room right now. So we need different products, but I'm not at all worried about our industry's product development capability. We've got plenty of smart people who can build these products. I think it's other areas that we need to change in. And we're going to quickly cover technology and data and some of the things that we might need to do differently in those two areas. So we've tried to describe the sort of flow, if you like, of what happens in getting from purchase. And a really big thing, if you haven't picked it up already, is even before buying a policy, a really big thing is how do you even get that awareness up? One answer to that, Mark mentioned it very briefly when he was talking about channels, the embedded concept. And familiarity with embedded insurance, just people know what we're talking about. Not so many, so maybe I need to describe. Josh, can you describe? No, I'll give a brief description. So embedded insurance, and it's actually a bit hard in Australia, so remember the obstacles, but remember the tailwinds. It's you're buying something else and insurance comes with it. So mobile phone with cover for breaking your screen. That's a classic example. But that sort of concept of rather than having somebody need to think about insurance or even you're getting your mortgage and you need a separate discussion to get insurance that might cover your loan repayments if you're sick. Oops, I talked about product. But, you know, that type of thing, could we get to the stage where it's actually embedded? And we did have some of that before when 20 years ago we were doing bank insurance properly. But put aside some of the regulatory constraints, it's that thinking. But what that also means is having the technology capability to actually embed the insurance into the program of whoever the actual product supplier is. And we don't always have that technology, but there are plenty of examples around the world, and there are actually vendors who will create that API integration for you, so you don't have to build it yourself. So buying a policy digital first, and we've used Flipkart as an example there. Post-purchase, Mark's mentioned younger generation wanting to deal digital. I actually think people want to deal omni-channel, depending on the point in time. But, you know, I've got insurance from many years ago with one of the preeminent life insurers in Australia. I cannot log on. I've been a non-advised customer since I bought. I want to change something simple or update something or check my premium. I have to dig through my paper files because I received a renewal letter. I can't log on. The appointed actuary is not in the room for that company. But again, that sort of technology is not mine. But, and I know some of you in the room, your companies do this. But it's some real basics that we have to get right before we can start addressing this community. Staying engaged, Mark mentioned some of the things about not necessarily the claim service itself, but also the other propositions, the other services. And I know there's attempts around wellness and various things, but it's thinking about what the consumer wants and then trying to give it to them. And there are some examples. We had lots and lots of our grads. When did Vitality come out? 5 years ago, 6 years ago, buying the Vitality product. They arbitraged and worked out that they could get free shakes. So it was the shakes that got them to buy insurance. But actually, I didn't have a particular problem with that because now I go to our grads and say, have you bought insurance? I go, no, aren't you an insurance person? Haven't you thought about it? So it's finding the things that will engage people along the way. And it's different for individuals. It's different for segments. Yeah, just flipping back to a mixture of those, how many people are familiar with flip insurance? Anybody? Nobody in the room? One at the back? And that maybe that's shine. Oh, no, I can see another one. So flip insurance is a product from HCF Life. Go and look it up. Whether you like it or not, the concept is basically, you've heard of slivers of insurance cover. Hopefully some of you have. Basically, if you're going to go hang gliding or you're going to go abseiling or you're going to go skiing, you switch on the cover for the period of time. So it's a sliver of insurance and it's a life insurance short-term disability cover targeted at physical injury, not mental injury. Interesting. Oh, wow, we don't cover mental health problems in an insurance product. Wouldn't that be interesting? So, again, the point is they've chosen a different segment match to HCF trying to talk to younger people. They've chosen a different way of getting it to market. It's a different offering that they're able to manufacture. Hasn't taken off in fantastic droves of customers, but it's part of a thinking differently that they're driving into their organisation. So it's not beyond the capability of anybody in this room to come up with that sort of stuff. Making a claim also, the illustration we've got on there is a bit about policy and payment data, but again, with claims, you know, do we need to think differently? You know, does my son, when he's sick and can't work, really want cash? maybe he just wants his rent paid. So could we embed the insurance with the rental company that when he takes out a tenancy agreement, the insurance is attached to that, he's made aware of it, he knows about it, and then the rental payment paid by the insurance company when he's sick doesn't go to cash to him, avoiding some of the issues that we have sometimes about people using cash because it's good. It just goes straight to the rental payment via the agent. And that he gets a confirmation, so he sees value, he sees his insurer paying, but it enhances the proposition of the landlord or the rental agent and solves a community problem as well. So that's some of the points around technology. Did I flip to data too quickly? I did. Hopefully you saw some of the technology things. Just on data very briefly, again, you know, we like to think that we're really good at this data stuff. So the question is, how do we use it differently to help us address this segment? I'll just give a couple of examples on this. And, you know, the analytics that we can do, I think QAR is the part of it, is a tailwind that we will get back to banks beginning to feel comfortable in talking to people about life insurance because it is such a natural trigger in that chain that we showed. And what I hope is that the banks who won't understand insurance and they don't understand the needs because they'll have sold all their businesses some years beforehand, what we can be doing as life insurers is bringing them the understanding of the needs and the thinking about why people want them, helping them think through what the right products for different segments are, and using data that we have in conjunction with them to come up with better marketing analytics and then help them address how do they target the right people at the right time with the right offer, that sort of marketing holy grail. So just that use of data and thinking about it that way. But it is a different skill set. Most of us work in it, for those of you who are in life insurance companies, most of us work in organisations that don't deal directly with customers. So we haven't got that skill set, that thinking ability we need to change. I'm going to move to the last couple of things, which is really walking out of the room, what could you do? And most of this is about thinking mindset difference. So firstly, on insurers. Mark said it, you know, we look at policy value, and even if we do embedded value, we look at policy value or product value. We don't look at customer value. Starting to think, in particular with this segment, that first purchase that Josh makes is not going to be a big purchase. That embedded rental payment is not going to be a big purchase. So your business case will fail abominably if you, as the leading actuary, put it up. If all you do is look at that single purchase and that relatively short-term product purchase at a low value. But if you start to say, this customer can be engaged through us in this sort of program over time and we can migrate them through the needs and because we're going to provide great services, they will align to our brand, that changes the business case. So thinking about the overall proposition from a customer point of view, not from an advisor or a super fun channel point of view, but from the customer point of view. We definitely need to help keep pushing on some of these regulatory barriers. Anti-Hawking's one, but QAR and being able to start to talk to people about specific needs. I was actually at APRA yesterday. I missed the morning here where they had me doing a bit of 15 minutes on the future of life insurance. That was a challenge. But then a panel with me, the CEO of TAL, the CEO of Zurich and the CEO of Cali. And that's the sort of messages we were given. They were asking us, how can regulators help? And we were all giving that message, keep pushing down this angle of letting us talk to customers, letting us help them with their needs. Distribution networks, hopefully you've already got that from our talking, but it's the ecosystem. It's not necessarily build ourselves as life insurers. It's how do we work with other organisations much more effectively. And I know some of you in the room are already doing that. And then the system challenges, you know, modernisation. We do have legacy products, things like that, but thinking differently about how we manage our systems and processes to actually help these consumers. So that's us and our employers. What about you? Another question for you. Hands up, please. How many of you have sat on a call centre call with customers? Good. That's maybe a third. How many of you sat in a research group with customers? even less. How many of you have actually sat in on a financial advice conversation that an advisor's had with a customer? Even less. So I know this one down there. So about the same. If you haven't done that and you're some way involved in thinking about product development and distribution development and the business as a whole, I'd encourage you, go out and do it. Sitting with an advisor might be a bit hard, but surely in your company you can go and sit in the call centre occasionally and you'll get an understanding of how real people talk, not how Alex's theoretical little caricature talks. It's really important if we want to understand needs. That won't make you an expert, but at least tune you to the sort of conversations. The great example that I think TAL has used out in the market is at the moment when somebody rings us and they say, how much insurance should I have? We cannot help them because we go round in circles trying not to give full personal financial advice. So the regulations, again, will help, but we've got to understand the customers to know what those questions, we think we know what they should be, but they might not be the questions they are asking. Evidence and data. So build those data-based, evidence-based business cases. That won't win the argument. Bring the EQ in as well, because it's got to be both a rational and an emotional business case that says this is why we should go there, but that's what we're good at. Think, I like this, I learned this earlier on, you know, the great actuary doesn't say no. The great actuary says yes. And I think we could do this as well, to basically say no, but to create a positive answer. Or, no, we can't do that, but we could do this. The bad actuary says, no, we can't do that. So don't be the good actuary that says yes and or no but, not no, we can't do that. So mindset. Data. And the final message, I guess, is be the leaders. You know, step up, lead us. Don't play in your little technical back office area. Help to make the arguments for this. Some of you are younger than Mark and me. You're the people we should be trying to help. Talk to the people around you. But in the same way that we're passionate about this topic, get out there and try and solve for it and make a difference. So thank you for listening. And people can come up and ask questions as well.
Thanks, Al, and thanks, Mark. So, feel free to send through your questions on the Q&A icon on the Summit app. We've started to get some coming through. So first one off is, how do you think the perspective of the underserved younger generation can be changed to see value in insurance when the rising costs of living are limiting their scope of financial choices?
I think it's kind of what I mentioned earlier on is, how do you create that perceived value? So it's in fact one step before that. How do you create the understanding of the need for insurance? And that's where I was going to. If people don't really truly understand the need, they're not going to seek out the product. So I think it's a combination of embed the understanding of the need, then be at the right place at the right time to have the conversation, because we all know life insurance is sold and not bought, and people are not going to go out of their way to go look for it. So how do you make sure you're there at the right time to have the conversation? And then when you are there, how can you offer something that's compelling? And to my point earlier, create that perceived value. So beyond just necessarily, oh, we'll sell you a promise. We'll sell you a promise, but we'll sell you a product. And the product can engage you in the following ways. And, you know, to the example I was talking about, Vitality, and I've seen it firsthand from friends and family in South Africa, how absolutely engaged they are. They don't even... The insurance is sort of a secondary thing. They just want Vitality because they want the discounts and they want the this. And it's just created such the sense of like community with the brand that people want to take out the product for all the other benefits. And then, it comes with insurance. That's great.
I think the other thing is, and I totally get the question about affordability and lots of talk at the moment about affordability more generally. But the other challenge I would make is that it's up to us to show perceived value, but also that this should be thought of as more of an essential. Now, if you put, is it important to have that short-term illness protection against your income against having your streaming services or having your mobile phone plan with Josh, my son, uses like 100 gigabytes a month. I don't know how. But, you know, the choice, it's about helping people to make some choices that put insurance, life insurance, higher up in the list. And some of that might be about embedding it and that it's not really a spend decision. It's a different spend decision. I'm buying my mobile phone, but I'm getting something with it. I haven't got quite the life insurance angle on that, but I'm renting the place and I'm getting the insurance with it. And then when they actually claim, that's that moment of truth. They go, oh, insurance is really good. And then they talk to their mate who rented through someone else and says, oh, geez, I could stay. I didn't have to move back into bloody mum and dad's place because I could be paid. So there's a couple of things around that.
Great. And we have another question from Alex Chen. I might just start with the question at the end, and there's a bit of a preamble, which is great, but takes a while to get there. So how can we position the business case for success? So given the relatively low demand, limited confidence and resistance from affinity partners towards insurance, along with low sales expectations and high setup costs, plus the uncertainty surrounding long-term value due to lapse rates, how can we position be best positioned for the business case for success?
Yeah, I might take that first and Mark add in. Absolutely get it. But it's probably 5-6 years ago that I was saying this sort of thing to the CEOs, and the response they'd sort of vaguely rightly give me was, well, you know, direct doesn't move the dial. Is the dial moving at all at the moment? No. The retail market's shrinking. The group insurance market is actually growing a little bit as new people turn 25, having post-PYS and PMIF. But the reality is we're not getting any growth in the market with the new customers. There's a bit of a debate whether advisors are selling to anybody new. But the dial is not moving. So we've got to do something to shift the dial. If you don't want to be focused on cutting expenses, you've got to find growth. And most people would rather find growth than they would cut expenses. So I think that triggers to say there is a future. APRA is asking us the question, how is our industry going to be sustainable? So I think there are plenty of good arguments to actually be pushing these business cases.
Yeah, and to the earlier point I made about, you know, lifetime value, you need to understand that if we're not getting people in their 30s and 40s and 50s as engaged in life insurance, or we're not getting the growth there, the younger generation of today is your working generation of tomorrow, is the bulk of the older age people tomorrow. So we're going to have to engage them at some point. It's why not try earlier and get a longer share of that that customer.
And a question from Shaz Karamali. In terms of what we're talking about here today, have you seen this done successfully, even partially, elsewhere? And I guess what are the key learnings, observations that could be leveraged on? I think you had some examples.
Yeah, look, you can all get the pack, presumably, but Shaz, wherever you are, happy to send it to you. Yes, and I did say I referenced the poor bank assurance thing in Australia. I'm old enough to have seen bank assurance when it was actually more embedded and working, and we had, you know, relevant insurance products sold profitably and sustainably with reasonable customer value alongside banking products. But we moved away from that and have moved. But bank assurance in other markets absolutely addresses this type of core problem. We're working with a client in New Guinea where we're being very conscious of good conduct. We don't have in New Guinea the same regulatory constraints, but, you know, we're going to put in place a very simple group insurance product attached to the bank loan, paying the bank if somebody dies. And these aren't big insurance. They're not big loans. They're actually small, not quite micro, but they're everyday cash loans for businesses or people. I think we've got to keep pushing against those obstacles and keep saying, how does QAR and the DBFO reforms allow some of that vertical integration? How do we, with good conduct, embed products and therefore use models like that, which we've had before here? You don't have to look overseas. You can look at our past as well.
And interestingly, before I was anticipating that sort of question come up. So first turned to Google, couldn't get satisfactory answers, turned to ChatGPT, still couldn't get an answer of where in the world has the best penetration of life insurance for the younger generation. So I don't have an answer. ChatGPT didn't have an answer. Google didn't have an answer for me. But if you look even within Australia, outside of insurance, we can see that, for example, the banks also do that well with, let's say, you know, student bank accounts and student products and trying to engage people with, you know, smaller, cheaper products that get them in
And again, once you get them in on a cheaper, you know, student-type product, hopefully you then can keep that customer as they migrate to fuller bank accounts as they start earning salaries coming in, et cetera.
And maybe just a question for me, just following on from the DBFO, so delivering better financial outcomes. And Mark, I think you touched on this as well in terms of the opportunities there from an innovation and from a technology-enabled solutions perspective. But I guess how does the industry, you know, better access that thought leadership to perhaps affect the step change that might be needed in this area to actually kind of get that awareness out there amongst the younger generation?
Well, you mean the thought leadership around how to do it or the understanding what the reforms are?
I think actually in terms of the innovation, the technology-enabled solutions, actually getting access to those and having the right people, you know, in the industry being across that so we can actually leverage it.
Yeah. Well, of course, come to Deloitte would be the... No, I shouldn't do that.
That was not a pre-prepared
club. Yeah, no. We didn't pay David to ask that question. No, but seriously, none of the stuff that we've said today is particularly ingenious. You know, a lot of it is common sense. And the reforms are not yet quite there. They're mostly targeted around insurance in super. And so there is absolutely an opportunity for taking some of these, what was a default conversation, to use the technology to actually start to say we can have different conversations in superannuation and top up the insurance that people are either getting as default or want more of. But, you know, to give an example of the technology, and again, I'm not trying to say come to us for it. You can do web searches and ChatGPT will help you on some of this. If you look up digital advice, OTIVO, O-T-I-V-O, full-fledged personal financial advice from beginning to end, digitized. No person involved, if that's what you want, or hybrid, supporting an advisor, or general advice. So those types of solutions are out there available and they'll do it either on a licensing basis or deliver technology to you as a licensee. There are some big steps to the earlier question. You know, it's life insurers don't distribute. There are a couple that have advice licenses. Again, DBFO starts to open up what an advice license would look like and companies may change their views as to their level of risk that they're prepared to take around the conduct things that we've seen. But lots of that technology, it's not actually hard to find examples of it. We don't spend hours searching for these. We're a bit more out in the market than some of you might be, so we hear about things. But the tools on the web for searching and just opening your ears to these things, going out and talking to people, you'll find the technology. It's definitely not a build-everything-yourself marketplace anymore.
I think we're almost out of time, but maybe one last question or thought for me. The presentation did touch on, I guess, the need to create awareness to kind of stimulate that demand, which kind of reminded me of Julie Masters' session yesterday around the new era of influence. Were there any kind of learnings you took from that you think could be applied in this area?
Yeah, was everybody at that presentation, the last plenary? Well, Mark's going to be the new insurance king as opposed to the lipstick king. But no, seriously, awareness is a big problem. Kelly is actually working pretty hard on trying to constantly reinforce the relevance of the industry. But I don't think the solution is for life insurers. I don't think an effective short-term solution, given the constraints that we have with shareholders with generally shorter-term mindsets, I don't think the answer is spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on marketing and branding. But this is why we went to the younger segment and showed you that channel, those sort of touch points. I think you can spend it much more effectively in selected areas and identify ecosystem partners and build around those. So find the organisations that have a base of people to talk to, a brand that's trusted, the reach, the touch, the control, the trust. Work with them and help them actually understand insurance and the needs because they probably don't understand it and don't know it about it at the moment. Also help them get over but what about the rules? What about anti-hawking? What about all those obstacles? Because there are answers to those. And if you have an attitude of how can we do this, not we can't do this, that changes the whole discussion. So.
Any more last questions before we wrap it up? I think we already had the 5-minute bell.
Feel free to jump on the mic. I had to move it down for me a couple of times.
Maybe then just one last one for me. Is there a role for the regulator in all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the regulators, and actually I think probably more ASIC than APRA in this respect, really. But when I mentioned that APRA session I was at yesterday, and one of the questions for us on the panel was, what can the regulators do to help? And there was Treasury, ASIC. It was an APRA session, but they had a Treasury and ASIC and an AFCA representative in the room as well. They do want to get out of the way, particularly APRA, I would have said, because there is a sustainability question for the industry as a whole. And it's not a core financial product sustainability. It's what do we offer that's relevant and how do we solve the community problem? I think there are some things to do around channel, and particularly, you know, it'd be great to see the retail advised channel changing habits and new products. But I think DBFO2, for me, there is this, you know, vertical integration in the Royal Commission wasn't actually banned. I don't think it's ever actually been said you cannot be vertically integrated, but there's absolutely a fear of that will apply in the people who are still doing remediations on past behaviour. So I think some of it is actually helping either provide safe harbour, so regulators can say this is how it can be done safely through guidelines, best interest duties, training for advice, the new rules as they come out with delivering better financial outcomes, helping to give guidance. But the regulators don't know this stuff as well as we do. So I think it's up to us to say, well, what would we like to see? Why would we like to see it? Here's the rationale and the outcome. And therefore, put the proposals to the regulators about how it could work and how, because they're conscious of conduct and harm, how are we going to make sure that we build so that it's safe for the community as well?
Great. Thanks, Al. And Mark, any final comments?
I mean, I just echo Al's. No, but yes. I echo Al's sentiments. I mean, I think it is a little bit, what can the regulators do? Well, how can they sort of get out of our way? In some respects, of course, they serve a purpose and they need to be there and they need to, you know, protect customers. And as Al says, maybe it is around providing those guardrails, but fundamentally we don't want the fear of regulation to stifle innovation, to stifle growth. And there's got to be ways around, as Al said, having the attitude of how can we do this rather than it's just too hard. And that's potentially how regulators can try and actually provide those guardrails or make themselves available to have the conversations and yes, we will allow this or no, but...
Great. Well, thanks everybody for your participation. Far be it from me to keep you from afternoon tea, but before you go, if you could just put your hands together and thank Al and Mark.